Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
Joining us now on the program, I assume he is with us, Pat Boylan, of course, you hear on the Pacers Radio Network for the pregame show. You also hear him during the course of the broadcast, working with Mark Boyle. Pacers Knicks tonight, game number six. Pat also, of course, well-versed on the Indiana Fever. So, Pat Boylan, I will give you recipient's choice. Would you like to begin with the Fever, or would you like to begin with the Pacers?
Fever were last night. We can start there.
Okay. I guess your overall assessment, I mean, it is, I will offer you the cushion off the top in the fact that the Caitlin Clark era is only two games in. And, I think there were people that thought it was going to be electric out of the box. There are clearly some learning curves. In your opinion or viewpoint, are the learning curves more just about, like, the team itself kind of figuring out how to incorporate with a new player, or is it about Caitlin Clark learning how to incorporate her game into the WNBA?
You know, I just think both of those are really significant, and both of them are, you know, very real learning curves that are occurring. Whether one is more than the other, I don't know that I see the game at a high enough level to know that answer. But I do think a few things are probably true here. One of them is, you know, I think anybody who saw Caitlin Clark for the last 4 years should by no means be doing any writing off of her or any questioning about her skill set or her ability for her game to translate. We're talking two WNBA games here, and she's done what she's done over the course of 4 years and done things at the collegiate level that nobody, men or women, have ever done. And so a small sample size of two games in 3 days, I think by no means should temper anybody's excitement for Caitlin Clark. I think she is still going to be the generational type of talent, and two games shouldn't change that opinion. At the same time, and it's something that we've talked about on our broadcast for years, there's not enough appreciation for just how good the players currently in the WNBA are. It's the top 144 women in the world. Debbie Antonelli had a stat through USA Today yesterday that 92, I think it was, of the 142 currently on rosters were college All-Americans. So it really is a big jump. And the final thing to throw in here, and there's nothing you can do about this other than, you know, lament it a little bit from the WNBA scheduling side, is the Fever have opened up with two of the top three teams in the league, and that's really not going to change here for the foreseeable future, because they're going to go play New York again on Saturday. Then they're going to go play Connecticut for a second time after that. Seattle's projected to be top four. They've got them after that game, and then Vegas won the championship last year, and that's coming up. So six of their top seven are against projected top four teams in the WNBA, and five of seven are on the road. So if the Fever open up with, you know, a couple teams that maybe end up near the bottom of the barrel this year, I also think it's very possible that these results and the Clark performances in the first couple of games look very different too. It's just a good reminder of how much talent there is in this league.
Pat, you stole part of my question there, admittedly, but I'll still ask it the way that we discussed it to start the show, which is to say, and I'm not, like, you know, I try my best to stay objective and not, you know, carry water or to overly defend where I shouldn't. But when I look with the gift of hindsight at the two teams that they just played, and you outline what is to come, those are two conference finalists, one of which obviously punches a ticket to the WNBA Finals, even though they lose to the Aces, in the Liberty last night and the Sun to open the season. So in terms of, as people start to experience more of the W and of this journey for Caitlin Clark, where is the balance between rookie struggles and, well, what do you expect? They're up against the very best the league has to offer out of the gate.
Yeah, and I think that's just it. It's like both of those things can be true. And I don't always love making NBA comparisons, because sometimes the parallels just aren't there, and sometimes it actually, I think, is a little demeaning to the WNBA. But to make a comparison here, the Fever have opened up the season by playing on, if this were an NBA, something like the Celtics and Milwaukee with Giannis and Lillard at full strength. I mean, that's who they've opened up with here. Two of the best teams in the league, as you noted, conference finalists. So if you were to continue this parallel and the Pacers had the number one pick in the draft, you know, coming off the season that the Fever have come off of, which was one of great growth, but still a lot of growth still necessary to come. You know, I don't know that anybody would go into those games and expect the Pacers to have a ton of success, because you're talking about well-established teams. All five starters for the Liberty have made an all-star team. Two of the five starters have been MVPs before. So I don't mean to make an excuse. I mean, certainly you would have preferred last night to be a closer game. At the same time, it was a lot closer for most of it. The fourth quarter really got away from them. You know, the Fever were threatening to cut it down to single digits late in the third quarter. And so as it relates to Clark, you're playing against a couple of the top defenses in the league. And I think when you just combine, everything's new here for her. The game is quicker and it's more physical. It's officiated differently. You're trying to bond with new teammates and gain chemistry on the fly. That's not easy. Your level of competition, you're playing players that have been in this league for 6, 7, 8 years and achieved some incredible things, including Breanna Stewart, who was magnificent last night. So I don't, it's kind of a balance here for me, because I don't want to say like we should have expected Caitlin Clark to struggle, because I don't know that that's the case either. She's phenomenally talented, and it would not have shocked me if she came out of the gates and was fantastic, but she absolutely deserves some grace and some leeway. And a comparison, too, I think you could make is Victor Wembanyama, who by no means was poor in the first 20, 30 games of the season, but there was very much a feeling out process for Wembanyama. And then if you remember the back half of his season, he was electric. I mean, that guy was undoubtedly playing at an all-star level from game 40 on or so. And I think you might see something similar as the schedule lightens up, as it evens out, as Clark gains chemistry with her teammates, as the Fever, you know, just gets some chemistry in general. I fully expect what you saw at Iowa, those type of plays, those type of highlights, to start coming up more and more. And we're just two games into a 40-game season here, so a very, very long way to go.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Pat, one other thing I wanted to ask about this whole thing. I think sometimes we look through the lens of the NFL and the NBA and rookies, and then we say, well, why, you know, the struggle early on, et cetera. It's probably going to be even longer because of the fact, and you've kind of addressed this point, but I think we need to remind people, this is a league that doesn't have 30 teams. This is a league that sees first-round picks get released through camp because of the fact that there are so fewer players. To me, it exemplifies why the WNBA, quite frankly, even though I know that it's a league that wants to continue to grow, but we've seen teams that have gone away in the WNBA. I feel like they shouldn't even, and I know this is crazy because it's about money, but it's almost like you don't want the league to expand because the competitiveness of where it is right now with the number of teams, it is a different barometer. You grade it on a curve that you don't with the NBA, right?
No, you know, it's an interesting point because at the same time, you're seeing some expansion come. Golden State is adding a team, and Toronto, I think, in a couple years at least reported. I don't know if that's confirmed. And personally, I do think the WNBA needs some expansion here for the exact point that you're talking about. There's so much talent out there that aren't on rosters that deserve to be on rosters. Because of that, the talent level, especially on the very top teams in the league, is more condensed, which I think is the point you're getting at. I mean, I this has probably happened before in the NBA, although maybe not. But when you talk about a league that's 75 plus years in the making, if you say, has this ever happened? The answer tends to be yes. But I can't off the top of my head think of an NBA team that has a starting five, that has trotted a starting five out there where everybody's been an all-star. I mean, maybe if you're talking about veterans at the very end of their career or something like that, but these are players all very much in the prime of their career in the Liberty standpoint. So, yes, the talent level is much more condensed in the WNBA in that everybody, you know, has good players, and the top teams are stacked. They're totally loaded. I mean, New York is one of the best teams I've ever seen on the women's side, and they're arguably not even the best team in the league. I mean, inarguably. Las Vegas beat them in the finals last year, so that's not even the top team perhaps talent-wise in the WNBA, although it wouldn't shock me or I think anybody that follows the league if New York won a title this year. But that's just where things are. And so I think as it relates to expansion, you know, cautious expansion is important. I think you get to 14 teams and you're still at a point where you feel like you've got a ton of talent still on these rosters while you are growing the game, which I think is important. But to the point of being a rookie in this league, the talent's not spread out over 30 teams like it is in the NFL or like it is in the NBA or like it is in most other sports. It's spread out over 11 other teams or 12 teams in total. And I do think that probably makes it a little bit more challenging for a rookie. And then, look, the obvious of she and all WNBA rookies have gotten no break. They went and they played all the way through their tournaments and then got drafted immediately and then went to training camp too. And that's something that other leagues just don't have. They don't have that challenge. Players get to kind of settle in, have some time, a longer training camp. And so I think all of those things are adding up to be a little bit of a challenge, but one that I see no reason that can't be overcome here and hopefully in the near future.
Indiana makes what adjustment tonight to get Tyrese Haliburton aggressive?
You know, I think it just kind of has to come from Haliburton. I mean, he had this already happen in this series, which is game number one. You know, he was talking about post-game, I've got to be more aggressive, and I will be in game number two. And he kept saying that, I will be better, I will be better, I will be better. And to his credit, he absolutely did that. He absolutely was better. He was fantastic in games two, three, and four. And then I think in game five, you maybe saw a little bit more of the challenges that affected him in game number one come back. And was just going back and watching some of that press conference from that game on Tuesday night, and he sounds the exact same. I wasn't aggressive enough. I wasn't, you know, hunting my own stuff enough, and I will be better in game number six. So to his credit, when situations like this have happened, he's taken it in his own hands to improve. He was, I think, at 34 points in game two, 35 in game three. Probably would have gotten there if the Pacers weren't up by so much in game number four. So it's clearly a major storyline tonight for the Pacers to keep their season alive. They're going to need to ride this home court momentum that we've seen. You know, the home court advantage has felt a lot greater in this series than maybe any other series in the NBA playoffs. And, you know, the Pacers are absolutely going to need to have to ride that type of wave here tonight to force a game seven. And obviously with anything Indiana, the level that Tyrese Haliburton is playing at, when you're in the playoffs, the levels that your star is playing at is massive to success.
Pat Boylan will be on the call tonight. Mark Boyle will be on the call. Pat Boylan will be, of course, assisting also all of the pregame coverage. Pacers and Knicks, game number six tonight from the Pacers Radio Network. Pat, appreciate the time as always, and hopefully you will have a busy Sunday as well.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you guys having me. Take care.
Pat Boylan joining us on the program.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Mario Andretti got a little pep in the step of that song. You've heard that a few times, right? An easy rider from the Charlie Daniels Band. Mario Andretti joining us here on Query & Company on Fast Friday for the Fan. All right, I asked you just going into it, the race that sticks in your mind the most that was not 1969 when you won here was which one?
Well, the one that comes to mind clearly and immediately is 1987, driving for Newman Haas. And with the Lola I had, my engineer was Adrian Newey, whom I consider one of the top ever, you know, as far as really understanding every aspect of the race car, suspension dynamics, aerodynamics. And anyway, if you look at the record, I was pretty much quickest every single day on the track, on pole. And I think I led 171 of 178 laps that I was in. And I had one and a half lap lead on Alonso. And
Roberto Guerrero would have been running up there, right?
yeah. But again, you know, I dropped the valve. I was, you know, really trying to run conservative on the revs, and that's what bit me. Because unbeknownst to me, I was running in the bad harmonics of the engine. You know, if I would have run, if I would have been pushed for the lead or something, it would have been better. You know, because I needed to be like 400 revs more. And that's against everything everybody's been telling me. You know, the car was, I was cruising home. The car was so good throughout the run, you know, from full tanks to empty. You know, I never had a car that stayed, you know, neutral to me, and I could really get after it and very easily. So, again, that was the biggest disappointment because that race was totally in my pocket.
So, in other words, the car that year, it's what the, if it was a racehorse, it's saying, no, let's go more. I got more here, right? Is that basically what happened?
Oh, I had more, yeah. I didn't need it.
Here's the thing. That has to be one of the few times where Mario Andretti actually said, I'm backing off, right? Because it's
I mean, I didn't have to. I didn't have to run 100%, obviously. And there's no better position to be in, you know, at the time. The car was really working under me. Like I said earlier, you know, we were talking about it, I said, starting that race, something very, very rare that you could think, you know, today they have to beat me. In other words, if the car fails me, you know, that's the only way they can beat me. That's how confident I was, you know, with that, which is rare, rare, rare. But, you know, to answer your question, that's the one.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Mario, during the break, I've gotten all kinds of messages from one of my oldest brothers who is going to turn 68 this year. He remembers you coming to, or he went to grade school, St. Jude, and speaking to him when you were a rookie on the circuit, to cousins of mine that are texting in. I remember growing up because of you, rooting for the Andretti family in any capacity, and this circuit and the speedway itself meaning so much to me and my family because of you. That's generation on generation because of what you've done for the sport and what Andretti Racing has done for the sport. What does that mean to you to be able to put that in perspective, knowing decade after decade there's still people that, because of your impact, love this sport so much?
Well, look at it this way. That's the highest compliment that I could have. And then on the other side, it's my fault if you, follow this. But I'll take that. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, if all I know is what it means, what it has meant to my family on both sides. Aldo and I used to say, you know, that we're the ones that started this mess, you know. And then as a family, look at 1991, 92. There were four of us that qualify for this race, you know.
Jeff, Michael, John, Mario, right?
Yeah, that's it. Jeff, Michael, John. And the pride is there for sure. And it continues. I mean, look at the way Michael now, you know, he's usually been, the last few years, been entering, you know, four, five, six entries, you know, for this race. So, and, you know, he was another one that was denied because of reliability factor. you know, he dominated this race, you know.
Boy, that 92 race.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he had more of those. But anyway, I kept telling Michael, I said, both you and I were born too early, I said, because the style of driving for us would have been today, because we were just flat out from the word go, you know, so we didn't have much patience. And with the reliability of today's engines, today's cars, I mean, it would have paid off for us, you know, much more than it did then. And so, but it is what it is. It's still, you know, I look back at all the laps that I, you know, I led more laps at all but one of the four-time winners, you know, so that's my satisfaction ultimately, that I got satisfaction out of every race that I entered here, so that's what I got to go with.
But you won everything. I mean, you're a Formula One world champion. You've done everything around the world, and your name is undoubtedly, and I've said this to you 50 times probably, but your name is the most famous race car driver of all time. I mean, it has become a euphemism for speed. So does the fact that you are the Indianapolis 500 champion, is that the thing that you put as the top of your pedestal?
Well, it's certainly at the top, but I mean, that year I won national championship as well. You know, I look a lot more premium at the overall season.
Right.
You know, of course, the star of the season was Indy. You know, but, you know, like in 69 with that championship, I won races, you know, super speed with short oval on the dirt, even, which counted for the points. I won even Pikes Peak, and I won road course. And that was the ultimate satisfaction for me to be able to, you know, put my mark in there in all the different aspects of that season, which was extremely versatile, you know. So that's what I got my ultimate satisfaction as a driver.
For those that are unaware, Mario Andretti is our guest here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Andretti Global is the name of the team that your son owns, Michael Andretti, formerly Andretti Autosport. Andretti Global, of course, because the team is going exactly that, with the aspirations of Formula One. And I know that you have, you know, championed that as well, to get that team into Formula One, and yet for whatever reason it is being blocked, I'll say, for lack of a better phrase. What is your understanding as to why that entry has not yet been allowed, and where do things stand?
Well, you know, in a short, we don't totally understand exactly why. We think we know, but we're not being told directly, except that you know, they keep saying that we don't bring value or something like that to the series. But we're you know, we're going flat out, you know, in preparing. So, you know, once we're given a green light, you know, we don't want to start from scratch. I mean, that Michael, you know, and his partners, I mean, they have the faith that the reason will prevail ultimately. And so we have a facility in England already all set to go. And we have a lot of progress. So, in other words, the objective is to be on the grid in 2026 with the new rules, and you know, once we're given the go, we'll, you know, we'll be there.
Is it a bias against having an American team, or is it a bias against having the Andretti name? I can't imagine why that would be, but what would your gut tell you?
I'm telling you, Jake, if if I really had a clear vision, I mean, a clear understanding, what was the issue? Because we comply with every aspect of the technical side, satisfy the FIA, and so on the commercial side, all of a sudden, that's where, and we're ready to obviously go with whatever is on the so-called Concord Agreement, you know, and if they want to change the rules, that's our issue. But we're complying with everything that's put in front of us. So I don't know what else to do.
What is one thing that throughout your entire career you're surprised you don't get asked about more often?
Why are you at so many races?
Because you still want to get in the car, right? Why are you?
You know, that's, you know what, because I just keep dreaming about being in a race car.
You miss it?
Oh, heck. I'm dealing with it, you know, and that was my biggest fear when I, you know, made a decision to retire, because I felt that I didn't want to overstay. I wanted to have, you know, a positive memory of my, you know, last days as an active driver, and I think I accomplished that. But like my wife always said, you know, I hope you can readjust to that. And my body actually acted kind of strange because even, you know, a professor there actually was interested in what was happening to me. He said, I think your body has been living for so long, most of your life on adrenaline, that now it thinks that you're dead.
so you got to go find new adrenaline, then, right?
You know, and when I first got in the race car again in 2003, when I got upside down here, I thought I died and went to heaven, you know, because, you know, all of a sudden I was in my element. You know, it's amazing how that reacted on me, but... It was a portion of my life that really huge change, but I'm learning to deal with it. But I feel that because of Michael being involved, you know, all the disciplines, you know, I feel that when I go to a racetrack, I have a home. And that's why, you know, if I go to a Formula One race, I don't have a home yet. So I want to have a home again. And that's part of it. That's what satisfies me.
You know, Mario, you were saying in the break, we were sitting here chatting, and you were saying... You try just not to dwell on bad things. You try not to have a bad day, right? You have this glow about you. But yet, the reality is, Mario Andretti, that the last handful of years, you know, I would imagine have tested that. I mean, I know family is very important to you. And, you know, we know that you lost your nephew, John, and your wife, and your brother, Aldo. Were there times where it has been tough and where you have had to truly dig deep to continue the same optimism and faith?
Yes, I mean, it's, yeah, indeed. I mean, again, and my sister as well, you know. So, yeah, there was a terrible period, of course. But these are the things that in life you cannot control, obviously. But you cannot be positive about that, you know. But it's part of life, and you have to accept those moments, you know. The things that I feel that I can control, I just... try to stay on the positive side for sure.
And I would imagine, you know, you're, and even as a racer, I think you were pretty scrupulous and true to staying towards your faith and your belief in that, which obviously has to have carried you for the last handful of years.
No question. No question about it. I never felt that I did it alone. I always felt that I had some help. We had an uncle priest on my side, and I know that he looked after me for so long, and he missed up a little bit on my brother, but something was working for me, and again, I take nothing for granted there.
You go back and you think about your father, and I love, one of the things I love about you, Mario Andretti, is when you post each year, because I can see what it means to you, the celebration of the anniversary of when you became a legalized citizen, right? Yes. And when you were, how old when you moved from Italy?
When we left Italy, I was 15.
Okay.
When we arrived in the States, 15.
And if I'm not mistaken, your dad didn't necessarily want you and your twin brother Aldo racing at first, right?
That was a father's, you know, the sport was... obviously had so many fatalities,
right?
That's all that he knew. He was not a race fan, and you know, he felt that, you know, kids, be real, you know, they're gonna come home in a body bag, you know, from one of the races. So, but you know, he came around and he was the biggest fan and everything. Then later after that, then he said, why aren't you winning every race, you know what I mean? he didn't understand that part either.
When was the moment that you realized that you kind of had the epiphany that your father had given his approval to your career?
Well, actually, yeah, I was in Trenton, New Jersey when I got my first ride in the Champ car, very first time. And I, first time I was on a mile track with a Roadster, 1964, and he was there, and I finished 11th, and I thought that was really a good start for me. And he was disappointed. He thought that I should have done a lot better. You know, so you could see that. God bless him. He didn't,
so Dad had a little racer in him too, right?
Yeah, but he didn't really understand, you know, that this is not a simple business, you know. But that was that. And like I said, once he realized that Aldo and I were all in, then he became a big fan.
You mentioned your curiosity of what life would be like after racing and into retirement. For drivers that get close to that point, or for people in general, that can be a tough transition, what advice would you give them when they reach that point where something you've done maybe your whole life has ended, but it does open up a new chapter as well, and that can be scary.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's just that this is such a personal thing, you know, because, you know, I'll give you an example. I think Michael, for instance, you know, he was at the top of his game as a driver, and he looked at the business side of it. You know, he thought, you know, because that could be for a long, long time, and he became a car owner immediately. And he's totally happy with that. So we all have different objectives. You know, we all love the sport in different ways. So I don't know what advice I could really give. Just try to be happy with whatever you pursue, you know. I know that, again, you know, with me, I stayed in the sport as long as it was anywhere reasonable. I mean, I stayed at top level until I was 53, but... I raced at 24 Hours of Le Mans, the last race, when I was 60, you know, and I would have tried to qualify when I was 63, you know, because Tony Kanaan had, you know, a wrist injury in Japan, and I was filling in for him, you know, in case I would have to qualify. Like, I've had guys qualify for me, Dennis Firestone and Wally Dallenbach qualified for me while I was in Monaco, you know, back in the 70s. So, anyway.
78, right? I think, was that the year that was?
Yeah, but twice they had to qualify for me while I was in Monaco.
So, in 81, are you still wearing the 81 ring there? Love it. So, Mario Andretti wins the race in 1969. You come back in 1981. Everybody knows the story. Of the controversy with you and Bobby Unser at the end of the race, and Bobby Unser is declared the winner. Then they go back and they say, no, wait a minute, Mario Andretti won. I had posted once on social media, and you responded to it, and I'm kicking myself I didn't bring it. When I went to that race, the first race that I attended was 1981. And afterwards, for school, I was in the I would have been in the first grade, and I wrote a paper about the 1981 race, and I said Bobby Unser won the race, but he passed cars when he shouldn't, and that's a no-no, and so Mario Andretti is the winner. And my mom found that initial school report that I wrote and had it framed and laminated for me, and I figured you absolutely would give me an A-plus on that school project, right? Because I said Mario Andretti is the winner of the race.
You're darn right. Well, Jake, I actually, by the rule book, I won that race because... They, you know, I was actually the first official winner because I got noticed 5 in the morning when Jim McGee, my chief mechanic, says they penalized Bobby based on the rule book. I mean, even Jim McKay and Jackie Stewart, even when he was passing those cars, 11 cars under the yellow, I said, you can't do that. You can't do that. They even knew then. But in those days, you know, today they would give you, you know,
in race penalty, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but in those days, you know, no computer and everything else, you know, they had, I was always traditionally go through the tape. That's why the race was never official until five in the morning, and then it took 6 months, depositions and everything else, and then you know the Roger Penske's lawyers, you know. That, you know, got USAC to agree with bringing in 3 outside judges to make a final and a decision. And the final decision was, yes, he did commit the, you know, the infraction, but the penalty is too severe, so they fined him $40,000 and they gave him the race back. But it gets better, and I'll say this. The following year, after the driver's meeting, I raised my hand and I asked Tom Binford, who was the race director, I said, if I pass 11 cars under the yellow today and cross the finish line first, is the fine still $40,000? And he said, oh, no. I said, so the rule book will apply this year, but it didn't apply last year. And, you know, to his credit, he says, yeah, Mario, I penalized him as a race director. He said, but I was overridden, you know. And so that was the part that I could never accept. That because, you know, I love Bobby, you know, we're good buddies, but, and, you know, I actually, I blame USAC at the time, you know, because they allowed outsiders to come in and determine and change the rule book.
Did it fracture your friendship for a while with Bobby Unser?
Well, he thought that it did because he felt guilty.
Yeah.
But
did he ever ask for the ring back?
Hell no. I mean, I don't care. You know, this I don't know if they gave him another one, but I was not going to give the ring back.
And so in the end, obviously, the two of you, you know, take me through the process of, I'll say making up. I mean, maybe that was more on Bobby Unser's end, but, you know, Bobby Unser was such another wonderful personality here, and the loss of Bobby Unser, and just, were you glad that things had been made up by the time that we lost Bobby Unser?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We, as far as I'm concerned, we definitely, I never blamed him. I just blamed the organization. He did what he could, you know, and Roger did, you know, they were allowed to protest and everything else. I blame USAC as a sanctioning body for allowing that, you know, that was a stain as far as I'm concerned, because if they would have changed the rule book, okay, the following year, all right, if you pass, you know, somebody across the finish line, okay, $40,000 the fine, you know, then I would have accepted that, but not the same only right. In that situation. So, I mean, there were examples of Johnny Parsons, you know, so, you know, had the best finish, he passed, it was less of an infraction. The next day he went from second to seventh, I think. And
I'd pass 22 cars and just pay the $80,000, right?
Yeah.
Call it a day, right?
I'd do that all day.
Okay, lastly, Mario, on this Fast Friday and watching the speeds right now, Chevrolet 1 through 7 on the speed charts, what are we seeing? What do we anticipate? Just your overall thoughts now down the home stretch here of these practice sessions before qualifying.
Well, you know, it's exciting. Qualifying is one thing, the race is something else, obviously, but nothing like starting up front as far as I'm concerned. And it's amazing now. It's really telling us something that the Chevys at the moment at least seems to have some advantage on the Hondas. I hope we can somehow figure that out.
Would you rather have a little bit extra speed or a car that you can go further on a stint because of fuel efficiency?
Well, I think, again, all of that plays for the long term, for the long race, obviously. You know, just because you're starting up front doesn't mean you're guaranteed to finish there. There are other factors in the race, but from my standpoint, I'll take power and speed anytime.
Every year at Christmas, Mario, and this is Christmas for a lot of people out here, right? I mean, this is Christmas
time. Yeah, for
sure. But every year at Christmas, the best tradition, I think, going on social media is you post your Christmas tree, and then you ask people to share theirs. And the thing that I think is so wonderful about it is people share with you their little family tradition or sometimes very modest Christmas trees, and you make every single one of those people feel like gold by simply finding something in their photo that is special.
Keeps me busy. That time we started that, and you know, we just decided to keep the tradition because it seemed like it caught on somewhat, and if people want to stay in touch in that, you know, fashion, I welcome.
But do you grasp the warmth it gives people?
You're not kidding. Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, that's to me, that's the ultimate element, you know, of I mean, there's nothing makes you feel better than that, quite honestly.
Then helping people out and making them smile. That's what it's all about, right?
That's all. That's
and you continue
about.
To do it, which is impressive. Two-time winner of the Indy 500, Mario Andretti, right?
You bet.
1969. I got to get a picture of the ring, by the way. I do it every year, but I got to get – it's fabulous. Jimmy,
awesome.
They presented you the ring. When did they present it?
You got to see. Oh, I got the
was
ring.
Was it the next day?
No, I got it at the banquet, yeah. Yeah, everything. I got the ring.
All right, hold on. I got to get Kurt Darling out of the photo. All right, give me a smile with that 81 there. That is just the best. Mario Andretti. Mario, enjoy it today, all right? And enjoy qualifying as well. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
All right,
thanks
the 1969 and 1981 winner of the Indianapolis 500, Mario Andretti.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Joining us now, who has covered both of those events and, of course, always keeping an eye on the Colts as well, from The Athletic is James Boyd. James, I'm going to begin actually with the Fever. The knee-jerk is going to be that Caitlin Clark is off to a rough start, that teams are guarding her defensively. It is a much more athletic league than is the Big Ten. But what is the window of time that we realistically need to give it before we can make a fair assessment as to the acclimation period of Caitlin Clark?
I know this isn't what you want to hear, but I would say about 15 games, maybe about half the season, 20 games, because it is a difficult transition. She's probably fatigued from playing a long college season and going straight into a WNBA season as well. And she's just got an immense amount of pressure on her shoulders. Like, everyone's not going to be Candace Parker and win MVP as a rookie, because Candace Parker is one of one. Caitlin is too, but just give her some time and, you know, it'll be fine. I'm not worried about her at all, but this was more realistic than maybe some people want to truly accept.
James, bigger level of concern in that same vein, Caitlin Clark figuring it out, or the Pacers, not just tonight, but the ability for them to actually take this series from New York, should it go seven? Where's bigger cause for concern from you?
Oh, Jimmy, you know it's got to be game six. I mean, come on, man. This is do or die, man. And I think that we've seen that, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of dance from this team throughout this series, and you don't really know which Pacers team is going to show up. Now, they're at home, obviously. I'll be in the building for that. And I would expect them to have a better sense of urgency, but it certainly is a bigger cause for concern for this team, because they really shouldn't be in this position. I mean, there's not, you know, too much to blame when it comes to having losses in the playoffs, but it's just how they performed. And some of these losses is kind of unforgivable. That last game can't happen again, and obviously they'll have a chance to bounce back tonight.
James, when you look at Pacers-Knicks, and in particular the aggression, we've talked a lot about it today, of Tyrese Halliburton, schematically, are there things that Indiana can do differently or draw up differently to kind of get that going and become more reliable on Halliburton getting to the rim, or is it strictly a matter of player understanding the switch that needs to be flipped?
I think it's more so the latter, where he has to just flip that switch. I think that Tyrese is an inherently unselfish person, not even just a basketball person, like a basketball player. Like, he's a really good person, very unselfish, doesn't really want the spotlight, but it's like, hey, man, you were the guy that came here and shifted this franchise, and now it's time to deliver. And I think that he would be really benefited by just shooting that floater in the lane. Jake, sometimes it looks like he can't get all the way to the rim. That's fine. Shoot that 6-8, you know, 10-footer, because they're playing off of you so deeply in the paint. So I think that he needs to be a little bit more aggressive in the paint, shoot a couple floaters, keep him honest, and then not wait to kind of heat yourself up. You know, go and get your offense and then get your teammates involved as well.
James, Tyrese Halliburton had mentioned this in the last couple of days in regards to him being more aggressive and his, you know, to paraphrase, is basically, I don't need to be taking 30 or 35 shots. It's more, as you highlighted there, being involved in the paint, maybe looking at more overall touches for himself versus making that extra pass that he so often likes to do. From his seat, is it as simple as 5, 6, 7 more shot attempts a game for where this team needs to go offensively? Or do you at all disagree with that, that maybe he does need to be turning himself into a volume shooter? In other words, can it just be a couple more shots here and there, a couple more paint looks here and there, or does it need to be a full, no, I'm going to steal a page out of Jalen Brunson's playbook and I'm going to take over this game?
I think it kind of depends on how he's defended, right? You would love to be able to say, hey, just go out there and get 40, because he can. But I think that he's at his best, the team's at his best, when he does have a healthy balance of both. Now, I will say that there are times throughout the game where I'm thinking to myself, okay, you get in the lane, why are you jumping and turning and passing to this other person? Yes, that might be a good shot, but sometimes I think you just need to call your own number and kind of establish yourself and tell the other team, hey, I'm here. You're going to have to defend me. And I think when he makes himself hard to defend as far as being a scorer, it inherently opens up his passing as well. I think that when the offense gets stagnant and when the Pacers look really bad, it's when he's forcing the pass because he's so unselfish. It's like, hey, man, if they're giving you the lane, go take it. And if you have to shoot 4 times in a row, I trust you as a scorer and as a shooter to be efficient in those shots. And so it goes against his nature, but I think this is the growing pains of him kind of figuring out how to play in the playoffs, because how you play in the regular season is never going to be the same as it is when you're in a game six, you know, with your season on the line.
James, I'm about to say something that proves why I am a radio host and not a coach, okay?
Okay.
But I want you to tell me, I'm going to put truth serum inside James Boyd, and I want you to tell me whether or not it is a thought that you have had at any point. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Jalen Brunson is aggressive. Jalen Brunson has moves that allows him, and the Pacers, in particular in New York, allowed Jalen Brunson to get right into his comfort zone inside of the lane where he then would either do a pull-up or he's kicking it outside to one of their two shooters that are feeding off of it. And that's taken place a lot, and they've tried different looks. I mean, Nesmith's done a good job, but gets some foul trouble. Nembhard, McConnell, you know, fouls are an issue as well. At any point, if it happens again and Jalen Brunson's starting to cook towards one of those 40-point games and the fouls are mounting, is it worth seeing if the rookie Jairus Walker can come in if they say, you know what, tell me what flavor gum he is and don't let him out of your sight for 5 to 7 minutes? Have you, James Boyd, thought that at all over the course of this series?
I have thought about it, but I vetoed it just because I think that you would really have to be desperate, reeling, no actual answers, because at that point you're throwing your last line of defense out there. And I just think that it would, you know, be sort of unfair to Jairus to throw him out there and say, hey, go save our season if you haven't trusted him to this point. And so I think they're going to do their typical guys. My thing is, even if you let Jalen Brunson go off or he has a big game, or even if you double him, just don't leave DiVincenzo. Like, if you're leaving Josh Hart open and he makes some big shots and makes some big threes, you might want to live with that percentage. But to me, it's when, you know, they're doubling off that first pass away and DiVincenzo gets a clean look, and I'm like, wait a second, everybody forget that he can shoot? And so that's my biggest thing. If you can kind of slow down Brunson or make it tough on him, even if he takes a lot of shots, get a lot of points, make it tough on him, you know, stay, you know, face guard DiVincenzo, I like the Pacers' chances.
James, which member or members of the Pacers, if things end tonight, which I don't think they will, we've yet to get, I think, Jake's official prediction, but I don't want to speak for him. I think he has it going 7. We'll find out when we make our predictions a little bit later in the show. But if it ends tonight and the brunt force of the blame goes to Tyrese Halliburton, right or wrong in that regard, which Pacers would get off scot-free because of the level of conversation around Tyrese Halliburton's lack of aggression and him being the franchise player? Which Pacers in this series would have and will get away scot-free because the conversation will mainly focus on what Tyrese Halliburton didn't do?
Scot-free, meaning that they don't deserve any.
Not a lot of blame. They've dodged blame because of Tyrese Halliburton's shadow being so widely cast.
I'll go to Siakam. They made the trade for you to obviously elevate this team. You know, he had those two big games in the Milwaukee series, but since then he's kind of tapered off a little bit. And then he also has missed a lot of free throws. And I think that that's one of those things that just irritates me as a basketball fan, because I know these games might come down to that. And he hasn't shown the ability to be trusted, at least in this series or in this playoff run. It's so weird. He's a pretty good free throw shooter throughout his career, but he's had moments where he just hasn't been that dude that the Pacers are expected to max out this offseason with his contract. So I think he's one that could fall under the radar a little bit. And as far as guys who get off scot-free with no blame at all, I think T.J. McConnell could run for mayor in Indianapolis right now if I could win, because that dude has brought it every night. And so I would like to see the mentality T.J. McConnell has had manifest itself in Tyrese. Like, I don't know if T.J. has to walk up to him and tell him, hey, dude, it's go time. But he plays with that level of aggression and that level of relentlessness with rebounding defensively. The entire team, I think they survive, push it to Game 7, and anything can happen in the Game 7.
James Boyd, by the way, of The Athletic, is our guest. He's on the always busy and shockingly unsponsored guest line. James, if you look at Pascal Siakam, wonderful player. Do not get me wrong. I have a great deal of respect for Pascal Siakam. Do you believe that if it's a 5-year deal, do you believe that Pascal Siakam's game fits cohesively and perfectly with the rest of the Indiana roster in terms of where they want to play moving forward?
I think that it does. I do understand that there's some hesitation there because of his age and obviously the money and investment, but it's kind of one of those things where in the NBA, more so probably any other league, you have to pay for projected value or pay for, you know, where you might be in a couple years. And obviously you're banking on, in that case, Benedict Mathurin, you know, taking a step forward, Jairus Walker taking a step forward, Tyrese even, you know, going to play for Team USA this summer in the Olympics and coming back and being a better player. So there is a risk there, but I think that he fits with this team. He's a low-maintenance kind of superstar. He's very malleable on the court. And, you know, I think that if you want to take that next step seriously, it'll come down to other players on the roster rather than him, because we've seen him sort of at his peak, and I don't see him taking another step forward now that we've seen him get to an All-NBA level.
Knicks guard Deuce McBride had 17 the other night in that win that the Knicks were able to secure, and kind of got his number called and had the perfect, you know, the perfect playoff arc that you want. If you're a player that's forced into a situation and then you're able to answer that call, that's great on the New York side. For the Pacers side of things, it's frustrating because a guy that would have been just a regular role player off the bench is now all of a sudden 3 of 7 from beyond the arc, 7 of 15 from the field, has 4 assists to go along with those 17 points. Alec Burks, I think, is what he's been able to do, might very well be sustainable in this series. But with McBride and that decision to go small by Tom Thibodeau and the Knicks, is what Deuce McBride did in Game 5 sustainable the rest of the series, or was that a one-off in a building that they're very comfortable in?
I think it's probably a one-off. However, I love this conversation, Jimmy, because people are always like, well, this guy will never do this again. He doesn't have to. They got the win. They got the fluky, weird win.
He had his moment.
Yes, I think that sometimes the series are determined more so by the anomalies than what we can actually bet or bank on. And so, you know, on the flip side of that, who's to say Obi Toppin can't have a big game tonight at home? Like, he hasn't had, you know, huge performances throughout the playoffs, but if he has a 20-point game, gets the crowd behind him, gets a couple dunks, that obviously will be a good case scenario for the Pacers to go on and win tonight. So sometimes you want to live off the anomalies, but I would say the biggest factor, like we talked about, is just Tyrese being aggressive. Be aggressive, look for your shot, not just look for your teammates, but if you have to, call your own number. And if it takes 25 shots for you to stay in the game, I think a lot of people will be able to swallow, and even himself, he'd be able to swallow a win or loss if he's able to go out there and say, hey, I went out there and tried to affect the game, and I wasn't just this bystander waiting for the game to come, you know, to me.
James, I've always wondered this. In baseball, there's somewhat of a home field advantage because you get to bat last, right? I mean, there's just something psychologically with that. You know, in football, there's somewhat of a home field advantage because the crowd can be so loud it can take the quarterback of the opposition where he gets confused by calls and cadences and has to you know, react at the line. In basketball, the reality is that you're playing a game where it's between the lines and you got 4 other guys on the floor with you. What is it that you think that makes for the true home field or home court advantage and allows the level of momentum that we see? It has been so obvious in this particular series. I mean, the home team has won each game, and in a couple of them, you know, easily, resoundingly, right? What is it? I mean, professionals can say crowd doesn't bother them, but it clearly does it not?
I think so. I think the weight of your missed shots at home don't feel as heavy versus on the road, and then the boost you get from your made shots is just better at home than it is on the road. Like, the reaction you get from the crowd at MSG, if you're a Pacers player, if you make 2 threes in a row, isn't going to be, you know, this huge, massive roar because you're on the road. And so I think that when you have those momentum swing shots as a role player, the basket looks bigger for you at home versus on the road. And I think that's something that no player wants to admit because they all give you the cliche of, well, it's 94 feet and the rims are 10 feet and all those things. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Why is your percentage so much better at home than it is on the road then? You know, it is a psychological part to it, but I think this also comes down to your star players, you know, your Tyrese Halliburtons, your Pascal Siakam, even your Miles Turners, stepping up, kind of taking the game by the reins, and then giving the rest of that team that confidence to go out there and just play freely.
James Boyd is our guest from The Athletic. We are, by the way, at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. You probably heard cars going past on this Fast Friday, fastest of the day. Scott McLaughlin, followed by his teammate Joseph Newgarden, and then Alexander Rossi, all of them over 233 miles an hour. All three, by the way, with Chevrolet Power. The three fastest in the course today are all Chevrolets. James, in terms of the New York side of things, we obviously know Jalen Brunson is the guy that the ball is going to go through him. But if DiVincenzo, and as you talked about, getting it on the outside and Hart threes as well, how do you balance that defense for Indiana in terms of their rotation, and who becomes the guy that you believe Rick Carlisle puts on Brunson first?
I think that Aaron Nesmith will be the player that Rick Carlisle puts on Brunson first. He's done the best job. You're at home. Maybe you get to play a little bit more physical at home, and you're not dealing with a lot of the head jerks that Jalen Brunson sometimes does to draw fouls. He's a great scorer, but we know all great scorers can kind of, you know, bend the rules to their will, so to speak. And so maybe you get away with some things at home that you don't get away with on the road. I'll add that, you know, even beyond defending DiVincenzo and other players, you have to stay connected to those guys. But to me, another key is rebounding. I mean, Isaiah Hartenstein can't be this huge force in the game where he's just creating extra opportunities for his team. Because if you look at the numbers, I don't even think the Knicks are shooting that great in this series overall. But if you get two and three chances at a basket, obviously your chances of succeeding go up. So, you know, make sure you have a body on Isaiah Hartenstein, the connection to DiVincenzo. I mean, you just live with whatever Jalen Brunson is going to do, because even if he scores 45, that's only 45. You got to figure out what the rest of your team's going to look like and defend to make sure no one else is going off as well and try to keep him a little stagnant. But, like I said, I think the Pacers have a good chance of extending their season. And, again, I don't trust them to play good or bad for two games in a row. I kind of expect the seesaw. So after a bad loss a few nights ago, I expect them to play well tonight.
James, to that end, we discussed this earlier in the week, but there's times when they're sending those doubles towards Jalen Brunson. It's not just your opening avenues for DiVincenzo to get free for a triple. You're making it harder on your interior presence on the glass because guys are having to recover. The communication's not there. And that's allowing a lot of those second and third chance opportunities to present themselves to New York. Is there a certain level, whether it is tonight or whether it's on Sunday, should they be fortunate enough to be in a game seven where you just forget about doubling Brunson because you know he's going to go for 40 anyway, and you make your sole focus the defensive glass?
Yes. The key there, I think, will be trying to keep him off the free throw line. That's the only thing. Like, when Aaron Nesmith gets in foul trouble, or when Jalen Brunson is able to, you know, get Andrew Nembhard out of position, drop fouls on him, that to me is when the Knicks are at their best, because, again, they're not playing many players, so if he can score with the clock stop at the free throw line, that benefits them. And so I think that there is something to be said about just letting him go off, staying connected, and rebounding. But then when I watch the game, even if you're out of position, there's just times where I feel like they're not making the effort plays. They're not playing hard enough. And that is what is bothersome for Rick Carlisle, who obviously yesterday was pretty mad about that and the effort his team gave. So I think they just have to play hard. Sounds, you know, cliche, you know, 50-50 balls, you got to get them. But I think that their effort level could be a lot better and their sense of urgency could be a lot better, because the Knicks, in certain instances, are not outplaying them. They're just out-hustling and out-willing them. And I think you take that personally if you're a professional basketball player. No one should play harder than you with your season on the line.
Antonio Davis is revving up the crowd tonight. He's a perfect guy that they should get out there to give him 10 to 12 minutes, right? Honestly, James?
I mean, you should do it.
We talked a lot about, and I know the season's not over, don't get me wrong, right? But if you look, one of the things that I think has been illuminated, in this New York series, and they're not eliminated yet, I get that. But if you look at what New York has done, that they the vulnerability that they have exploited of Indiana, and that is the Pacers, we can talk till the cows come home about the need for the 3D wing defender. I get that. But, and these guys aren't necessarily ubiquitous in today's NBA, but going out and getting a Dale Davis molded or Antonio Davis molded player, but a guy that gives you strictly a 15 to 20 minute per night guy that can give you some defense, a little bit of nastiness, but keep possessions alive, I think Indiana is lacking. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that would definitely be something to look at to upgrade this summer. A hustle guy, even James Johnson, who brings that toughness to the roster, but doesn't play. so you don't feel it as much. And so if you can get a, I'm going to get, you know, killed on a radio for this. If you get a Bobby Portis type of player or someone like that,
you're right.
You can go out there and mix it up, you know, score a little bit, grab some rebounds, but just bring an edge to the team. I think that would help because inherently, I think that Tyrese, he has an edge to him. He's a very, you know, fierce competitor, but he doesn't outwardly show it in a demonstrative way. Miles Turner isn't really like that either. And if you can get someone who's like that, who every now and then gets a tech and you're like, what are you doing? But they're in it and they're alive and they're passionate about it. That could help them a ton. Because like I said, the Knicks, you know, have a couple of wings that are, you know, big time players like OG and DiVincenzo. I guess I would count as a wing, but they're also, again, they're a team that feels like just a bunch of junkyard dogs. A bunch of like, yep. Some of them are like, still
totally
like
agree.
And it's like, I'm just trying to survive and get my next meal. And you need that hunger kind of infused in this Pacers franchise.
I just kind of feel like, you know, we all had that guy in our group of friends that your parents, like, you know, they were cool with you being friends with them at 17, but they're like, you know, if you're still hanging around the guy at 25, it's probably a problem. But you were okay with it at 17 because you knew as long as they were in the car, nothing was totally ever going to hell break loose because that guy was kind of with your crew. And I think Indiana needs that guy, right? You need just a little bit of crazy. And I know that James Johnson is that, but he's not on the floor. I'm talking about a guy that just kind of holds everybody together. And it feels to me like that's the missing piece for them.
Oh, absolutely. Jake, quick story. One of my best friends growing up, we went and played at a church one Sunday, and this guy fouled me super hard. And my friend, you know, I pushed the guy. I'm not going to fight in a church. My friend was. He stepped in and was ready to duke it out in the middle of the holy place. And so, yes, that friend is exactly who you're talking about. Because my parents knew he might not be the best person to bring around all the time. But if you go anywhere, you play anywhere, make sure, you know, my best friend or one of my friends, Chuck, was with me. So that was definitely a lesson learned there.
But if you told your parents senior year in college you were dropping out to go live with Chuck, that's when they're probably like, I don't know, man. The guy was throwing fists in the church, right? But at the time, it was
down,
you needed that, right?
Hey, if you're out, make sure you're next to him because he might hit something, you know, and make sure you're okay.
James, whether it's finding a physical enforcer presence, as Jake outlined there, or whether it is finding that missing 3-and-D piece, and I know these are better for offseason questions, but the point of the question is relevant because of who's on the other side of the floor in Jalen Brunson. I know it's year 6 for him. I know the other name that I'll reference here in Nikola Jokic has been around for a good minute and has established himself. Those two players, and they do things wildly differently, and one is a generational talent, and one is having an incredible playoff run. But in Brunson and Jokic, they both have in common being second-round selections. In today's game, can you realistically find value like that that you can develop in the second round, or are those two just anomalies and it really is a diamond-in-the-rough crapshoot once you get to that second round of the NBA draft?
I think it's the latter. You know, you would love to be able to say, you know, if you're the Pacers, hey, we're going to get a steal in the second round. You know, Andrew Nembhard's a second-round pick.
Andrew Nembhard,
but
yep.
To think you're going to get a superstar is just highly unlikely. I don't think anybody expected Nikola Jokic to be as great as he is, obviously. If they did, he wouldn't have went that late. Jalen Brunson, even on the contract he's, you know, on, making $100 million worth of money, he's underpaid. Because he's a superstar in New York for this team. And so I think that the Pacers are in a good spot. They have their superstar, their star, and Tyrese Halliburton. I think that it just comes down to him going through the growing pains of being the star kid. You know, he came here. He won everyone over. The expectations weren't that high. But now the expectations are here, and he has yet to sort of deliver, if that makes sense. Now, I'm not going to look at this season as a failure that they lose tonight by any means, but it will be a sting because it's like, hey, we had this golden opportunity. Some fluky stuff happened with injuries on our side and even on the opposing side. So we're right there. Let's capitalize on it. Let's keep this thing rolling. I think it comes down to Tyrese and what he wants for himself in this season. But by no means am I going to, like, you know, write this guy off. You know, his first playoff experience, first playoff run, he's okay. It's just that you're going through the sort of, you know, new chapter of this where you no longer the honeymoon. You know, everyone loves you. You're going through the, okay, you're a star now. You have to produce like one.
Last night he was covering the Fever. Tonight at Gainbridge Fieldhouse, Game 6 between the Pacers and Knicks. James Boyd representing the Athletic. And if you want to start any static, Chuck is watching. James, we appreciate it.
Appreciate that, guys. Have a good one.
I appreciate it. James Boyd from The Athletic.